Hi, Stephen Ternik.
Hello, Otto.
Stephen, we have been talking about many different topics, and all of them come out of our shared interest of the quality of human life, health,
yes,
physics, metaphysics, and also economy. We've been dealing with economy and different perspectives already, and yes, in a way we came to realize that we need to go deeper into the psychology of economy. We looked at quantum economics, in which not money, but the quantum is the fundamental unit of change. We looked into socionomics as a system in which the relationship between people is actually determining what happens. We've looked at geonomics, which is a view on connecting it to our survival on Earth and
yes,
optimizing the qualities thereof. But in a way, we still have some problems of something that is a bother to a lot of people, and that is, I would call it, the superstition of money, or the pervasive role of money. I also call it the money addiction. And then you suggested that maybe we could address that under the title of the enigma of banking.
Yes.
And I think that is a very good approach, because it is very clear that people depend on money in very many ways, more than they realize.
Yes,
it is
yes,
also the case that the people who determine what happens in money values, they're not known. The laws by which bank money operates, they're private laws. They're not known to the general public. And so essentially there is a very small group of people who, let's say, regards the rest as cattle and provides money for the rest. And if I look back in the history, it is as if the people who learned to chase and tame and imprison animals, they call it domestication, did the same to people. And I'm quite aware that we will have to deal with some superstitions that everybody has gotten used to live with. Everybody has stopped questioning what money is and where it comes from. Everybody is puzzled by what determines the values of money. And my interest is basically to go to the level of deeper healing and to come to a diagnostics that is, that we don't look at the pus forming on the surface of the body and the symptoms that we see in the world of finance and economics, but that we actually go and look inside and see what creates that belief or the superstition of money, who operates that system, that is, who are the priests. What is that religion which is kept secret but yet controls the life of everybody? And that means that we shouldn't really look at economics as an accounting of values or attributed values, but that we need to look at what these values are on the basis of the beliefs of people, and more specifically of the manipulation of the belief of people in general. I'd like to ask you to basically give a perspective on what you see as the enigma of banking, so that we can then compare that with the way I look at it, and together maybe we can find a pathway for other people to get out of this situation where they're essentially imprisoned by money, like those animals of the hunters in the faraway past, and that they also realize that money is a symbol, and that it operates at the system level of beliefs, and that it is manipulated by, let's call them, priests. So that's quite a thing to explore, so I hope that we can have quite an interesting series of explorations on that.
It's a big fight.
Yeah. So please start with your perspective on this.
I would buy this big pie, but I try to buy some bite into it.
Yeah.
It's one thing is important here. When I started writing about these monetary issues, and for example, 2011, I wrote this book on heuristic economics. So it's it was a little bit a provocation, because heuristic economics is for many people, they say this is total idiotism. You know, why do you write about heuristics? Heuristics is heuristics. Economics is economics. Money is money. But behind that wording was something like this: people, they search for money. You know, there is people in search for money. It's heuristic economics or monetary heuristics. So it's search for money. And if you go into the meaning of money making, you have different languages. It starts even with a language. We have in Hungarian, keres pénz. Somebody keres pénz. Somebody is looking, searching for money. Keresni. And then you have the German, verdienen Geld. They not only work for it, they deserve the money they earn. You know, to verdienen, that means you deserve what you get. You deserve it. Hmm. You have gagner d'argent. It's also winning the money. You have making money. Make it, subsidy produce it. Of course, you have to have earned money. So you have many meanings in the language. So a heuristic economics monetary heuristics was about people are searching for money. So they are not. So they have lost the basic insight into life that they at first have to breathe air, inhale air. They're searching for money, but while they are searching for money, they forget to inhale air. So everything becomes very fast in such a system. And as you said, people think afterwards they are better than others, so they buy money, they try to build these big walls, invisible walls, and but if you look back to the monetary history in Sumeria, and then we have the first records in this Ur-Nammu codifications, and we can see very clearly that money has been covered. It has so there were clear definitions that I was telling you, enigma of money, enigma of banking. And you can see exactly the portions have been defined. If you have so many grams of silver in money, you have so many grams of barley. So there was always, money was directly connected to a natural ratio. Directly connected to a natural ratio. You had so many grams in barley, make up for so much money. So make up for so much silver. They also already used the word shaker, shaker. Mm-hmm. And so you see, when the whole thing started, and these were our first records, so we, this in not in history books only, but these are archaeological facts, and then always money had a counter value, or a natural ratio, and this has totally got lost. Within this last, I would say, 400, 500 years, this got totally lost.
Mm. Stephen, I'd like to add a bit before we go into that abstraction that money represents. Yes. At some point, I was looking at what happened before we got at that level that so many pieces of silver represented so many pieces of barley. And then in my mind, it all starts with people sharing the food that they find on the planet. And with tribes, hunter-gatherers, coming up with whatever they can find, sharing it with the other tribes that they meet up with.
Right.
And then at some point, they discover that the one tribe has something that grows in the autumn, the other has something that grows in the spring. And they share what comes in the spring together, and they share what comes in the autumn together. And then at some point, that went from sharing to trade or barter. That they said, okay,
trade,
we brought
trade,
so much.
Trade. Or, is difficult.
There is a difference in philosophy. It's no longer about sharing and giving, essentially, but it's about trade and accounting. And so in my mind then, I saw these people traveling, and they had these sacks of barley, and they went over the hills, and they were over the mountains, and they were over the desert and met up with the other people. And then at the other side, they got this receipt for so many sacks of barley, and the Babylonian accounting system, that the number system was actually little clay effigies of barley sacks, and then they would put 12 of them in a larger envelope, or how many as they were reckoning with.
Yeah.
And at some point later, they just drew the number of the sacks within that envelope on the outside, and later they just wrote down the number on the outside without putting it in. But then I also had in my mind the further development that when people came back, they would use counters of how much they had, so that at the next time they could show, okay, we brought you so many. Now, what is your rice amount of bags, and so on?
Yes.
And then evidently, instead of using wooden counters, it would be easier to use pebbles, because they don't rub off so easily. Of course, gems are more rare as pebbles, so that people couldn't just go to the valley and pick up pebbles and say, you owe us. And so at some point then diamonds, of course, they are harder, so when you run around with them, they don't get worn so much, so that would attribute the value of diamonds in that pebble counting system.
Yes.
And evidently, when you have golden nuggets, there is advantage that when they get worn and torn, you just remelt them and can use them again and say, well, we had so much of this gold here, so we'd like to have so many bags of barley in return.
Yes.
And then you, in a way, at least for me, then I got a satisfactory way of understanding how it could have gone from bags of barley or whatever foodstuffs they were trading to a counting system, which first was wood, pebbles, and then gems, and then diamonds or gold, with diamond and gold still being kept on the background as the counterpart of the, let's say, the counters for the accounting of how much was brought from one side to the other. But there is a different thing that goes on later when, let's just go from the barley to the stones, to the gems, to the diamonds, to the gold. Basically, they're just counters. It doesn't matter. The importance was that it was not something that people could just pick up anywhere, that you could actually say, well, this is something that we can now use as counter, and people cannot pretend that that we brought more bags than we actually did. And that's also putting the symbols of it onto the counters, so that's where you then have money.
Uh-huh.
But there is a difference when that accounting sort of starts to run away with everything. And evidently there is this, the Silk Road was already long existent before anybody knew about it. People were trading over very long distances. The Celts have already been described as visiting far places. The Vikings have been reported to be in Persia and other places.
Yes.
So tourism or world traveling existed for a very long time already. That's not new. And so a trade with tribes which have a different language, different culture, a different counting and accounting system would, of course, be logical to sort of have to be able to reckon with that as well.
Uh-huh.
But then there is a transition from this basic accounting or reckoning or calculus to the abstraction, and you were just going into that. I just wanted to add this perspective of a shift of meaning from stuff that we can eat to stuff that we cannot eat, but that the stuff that we cannot eat, like the gold or the diamond, is basically a representation of an amount of stuff that we can eat. And as you said, in Babylon, they already said, so many grams of silver equals so many amounts of barley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, maybe we'll end up like this Indian tribe leader who said that one day they will understand that they can't eat money. There is this, this song about this Indian tribe leader who said they will maybe recognize they can't eat money. This was a critique of the white man. We have also to go more into barter and the gift economy. So in my text on the enigma of banking, you can see this distinction. In many times, and a lot of long, very long time in history, people had a gift economy. So it's like exchanging gifts. And barter was only used when a culture encountered another culture. So when the cultures, if you not were alien, but they didn't know themselves, they were trying to barter something with something. So barter is something that evolved in the connection with strangers. And within tribes, and of course families, but within communities that know that who know themselves, the gift economy was dominant. And only if the culture was not very well known, then this barter came as a measure. And there also, if you look into Hungarian history, you have many records of barter. So we came to this new Central Europe, and there are also records from an area today Ukraine, where the Khazars were living. And so you can see, okay, outside trading was generally done with barter.
Yeah, I think it's very important what you're addressing here, because this is so fundamental. Yes. It is the difference between the us and the them philosophies.
Yes, of course. It's not only the language. You know, today people are also mixing, but in ancient times it was very different, because you really had these tribes info. I think you can say even would clearly say that racially. There are records, and you can see people are really like in many other regions today, that people didn't go too mixed, and there were tribes, and these tribes these are different. These are the Slavic people. We are the Magyars. We are looking different, and we are bartering with the Slavic people. This and that basic measure. Exchanged with these or that, no, and barter with strangers, gift economy inside not only the tribe, of course, there were greater organizations like the Bulgarians. Around 600 were already being organized as a state, maybe the eldest state in Europe.
I'd like to connect up on this, as you noticed. There is this link which you are now putting in, which is so very important and so very often forgotten, that when you notice this difference between the us versus the them, that of course is encoded, how you already mentioned the Khazars, that has been encoded in all kind of religions. And religions are of course the collective belief system of a tribe. It is that difference between the one tribe and the other which basically then puts a boundary on the tribe, how this culture and these traditions and these crazy beliefs define us.
Most important is marriage. Marriage is most important, exogamic and endogamic tendencies. You have to the sexual side of the sexual side is important. Exogamy, endogamy, you have...
Yeah, let me just go to a deeper level, because for me...
Okay.
The marriage laws, or the birth rights and the death rights and all that, they are part of, they're just an offshoot of this discrimination between us and them. And there is a fundamental importance in realizing that this cultural difference is expressed as a religious difference, because at the basis of many of the belief systems you find that there is a so-called holy book. And in my mind, holy books are always written by people for a political purpose. That I don't consider them that holy. But the fact is that people in that culture will abide by that group, and they will use it as a basis for their legal system, but it is also a basis of their financial system. In that way, the Torah is the basis of a financial system. The Bible is the basis of a financial system. So it's not just a book of law for the people who want to believe in that, but it is also a book of banking. And it is this level which I find very important to understand, because as you mentioned, The difference between the us and the them philosophies also means that there will be a religious conflict, but that religious conflict will of course always be addressed at the moment that you're using finance, because as you mentioned, finance is always used with the stranger. So in that sense, you cannot have finance with a stranger without running into them being a stranger with respect to your own religions. And that means that the religious conflict will in a way rub off on the financial interactions. And that in a way we see now as all of the wars being the prime instrument of economic gains.
So it is important
to understand what happens at a deeper level.
Finance is an extension of the territorial behavior.
Finance
is an abstraction, or an abstract extension of territorial behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else.
So can you say a bit more, you already started to talk about the Khazars, when you go into this understanding that it is an extension of the territorial behavior, then of course you will also need to be able to resolve the religious conflicts or the religious differences.
The finance is used. Come look at today, whatever conflict you see. You look in Yugoslavia, what happened? You had the hyperinflation. You had a financial problem, and this caused the civil war. You also can see clearly that there were religious problems. So you can, if you look into the conflict afterwards, you have Srebrenica, you had these killings. So then, of course, you have this getting ready of somebody in this conflict. So it's Yugoslavia is one example. We have too many examples, so we won't finish today or not even today. It's an extension of the territorial behavior, so in abstract terms. Then I think that this, what you say, books, holy books, yes, so most of the holy books and all holy books are reduced into contract law.
That's very good that you mentioned that, yeah.
It's a contract law. So, or if you look at a marriage certificate, an ancient, you look in, okay, it's looking nice in Hebrew, this marriage certificate are looking nice, the ketubas and all these things, you know. But of course, there are terms of trade are being clearly fixed. So, you have even there, the marriage certificate is looking nice, you have the baldachin and all these things around. But it's a contract law, and it's one part of human existence. Is you, I wouldn't say to force somebody into something, but you try to make things accountable, that the other side won't take this or that. Like when my wife said first time. That she know people and they fixed it. I brought in the house, you brought in the car, and they wrote totally into you know into contract, you know, and it's very interesting. And, but this is people, especially marry from different backgrounds. So it's something like you come, you marry now, for, and then you come into some other class. And you accept the rules of the other class, so you don't have only the tribe, as a racial organization, but you have also classes within the tribe. That's very important. So you have within the tribe or within the racial organization, you have also classes. So classes, of course, possessions, and as I want to write clearly down, I just wrote an article about Hungary, the Hungarian Jewry, and about the class stratification in Hungarian Jewry. And of course, some absolute exact form of contract law was not used everywhere, but some classes of the some strata used exact contract law, because they wanted to exactly fix. You had the vineyard, I had that. you had this, I had that. So, and they put it into a contract. This abstract involvement of money, banking, and I did many of these PhD level trainings in Switzerland. I was always, when I dealt with these topics, I always thought, okay, Calvin made good translations of the Bible. If you look at that point, so you have had something like it's Calvinism. It was Calvinism in my terms, and Calvinism also does mean you can do what you want, but you shouldn't enjoy it. You know, and so you have, of course, you have the, some religious background program. You can do what you want, but you shouldn't enjoy it or something. You have a religious background program.
Yeah, can I connect up to that? Because something which is very important at all of these levels, when you look at Calvinism, basically it is about the idea of personal enjoyment at the expense of the collective. And that seems to be the problem which has not been resolved by any financial system, any banking system. And it is also seen in, for example, the Pope wearing a tiara, claiming ownership of the earth, of all living beings and their soul. And of course, a Pope has no entitlement to do that, because earth already existed before life forms developed here.
Yes.
And there is a very different perspective. And when you look at Calvin or the Pope, then essentially it is about the relationship between the human and humanity.
Yes.
And that is also one of the reasons why I am very glad that we are doing this exploration about the enigma of banking, because banking seems to abuse that relationship between the individual and the collective. And one of the basic abuses is at that deepest level, which you just started to address. That not just the tribes, the classes, and the families all have the interpretation of ownership laws, but also that the Torah, the New Testament, the Quran, and other books, they all define what can be owned, but the people who make those claims are not made responsible when those claims are evidently false, and the books are not corrected. And so when people in a court of law in America have to swear on the Bible, and they stop doing that nowadays. Basically, they say that they abide by a book as the basis of moral and financial agreement and disagreement.
But this gets disconnected over time, you know. Even Calvin, when he started that thing, and this spread it to...
True, there is a difference in that, but still... in those books, false claims are made which have not been resolved. And as a result, people can claim that they own a piece of land or something like that. While in the conversation about geonomics, you made clear that, in fact, nobody can own the earth, and thus nobody can own the land, but everybody can be a caretaker of it and bring it to fruition and then share the fruits with others. And so there is something at that level which has to do with the relationship of the individual. Are you working for individual gains? And Calvin says that's not what it is about. It is not for your unique individual pleasure. And that is something else than you should not enjoy what you do. No, you should not enjoy that for selfish reasons, like a psychopath would do that. But there is a level of growing out of this individualistic interest to a collective interest, and it is as if these so-called holy books and their interpretations as book of laws and their interpretations as book of finance or economy, they do not take that into account. And that's also known as the problem of the commons. There is this common field, but when individual farmers put more sheep onto that field, if they have more sheep, the field will lose its grass, and everybody will suffer as a consequence. So there is something that is needed to relate the individual to the collective, and I can well understand that Calvin said, when you do things, don't look at your private gains or your private enjoyment in what you do, but bear in mind that we're all doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but it's important to understand this when I detected that article, and okay, you have in every country is different, and Calvinism is not Calvinism. You have different streams, but
yeah, but what I try to address is that those are just beliefs and definitions.
Yes,
and
of
in
course.
A way, we cannot use these books as the basis of beliefs and basically
yeah.
superstitions, because they are applied to other people.
I think that if you look at this enigma of banking and look at gravestones, and in the gravestones it's inscribed he had that at his birth, then he had that when he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And you have many of the cemeteries like this. So even on the gravestone, the tombstone, they want to show I had this at that birth, and then this came. So it is about predestination and economic success. Economic success shows you on this globe that God is in favor of you.
Yeah, and in this way the priests support the politicians, and the politicians support the priests.
Yes,
but the responsibility of both
exactly.
and everybody else is out of the
and
picture.
He says, okay, we have. I was visiting such cemeteries. Uh-huh. I took photos. And this guy, and it's not important if this only is in Hungary, there are a few of them. In the US, there are more of these types of cemeteries. And they said at the birth he was such a small sausage, and then he became a very big sausage. So and so it's measured, and then he left these or that. That's one point. And I think, of course, I do support economic success, but not on the cost of others. That's the main happened today. So what happened today in the last 30 years is what we have is the last 30 years, or what's different. After two world wars, there was something like a basic common sense, a common sense.
Hmm.
This was applied, and I wouldn't say social market economics, but some basic common sense was accepted. And after, I would say the last 30 years, so we can put it around the 80s somewhere, 85 or somewhere, 80, in the 80s started, in
mm-hmm.
Then it became this neoclassic applications, the neoclassic applications of economic thinking, classical mechanics, again, in the economy.
Yeah.
And as you said, you are better than me because I own more and you own less. And of course, in the background, even it says no official religion, religion is being used. And King Solomon, we all of us know that King Solomon didn't know much about capitalism, you know, that's also for sure. So you cannot look into King Solomon, you can look for wisdom, but
yeah.
not for dealing with modern economic affairs.
Yeah. I have difficulties interpreting these books. Let me put it this way. I refuse to believe them at face value. I once read a book by a spy of South Africa, and he said, well, when I look at all these books, I can see my colleagues at work. So these books have been edited in all kind of ways. So I will not accept them in the way that they are written, but there are very interesting views in there which have values if interpreted in a more general sense.
Yes,
and I would like to link that up to something which came up in my mind while you were talking about the properties and ownership. And essentially there is this view that that's called a burial shirt does not have pockets, which essentially means that when you die, there's nothing of the material stuff that you can take along.
Yes, you not, but you can inherit it to another generation.
Yeah, but just leaving that aside for the moment, I'm just looking at what happens when people die. So the material stuff they cannot take along, But what they do take along is what they have become. And so in that sense, properties are actually the characteristics of the way that you live. And properties are not the materials that you live with. So in that sense, as you described in geonomics, the material stuff is something for which you are a steward, caregiver, or caretaker.
Yes, absolutely.
And the real value in a person's life, if they're a big sausage or a little sausage,
yes,
is how they have grown in outgrowing their own limitations and growing up from being an individual,
yes,
say a
absolutely
human, to
yes,
being connected to humanity. And that is what all the yes mystic trainings are on about.
Yes.
So there's part of that deeper understanding in all of the mystical trainings, and you find some of that in the so-called holy books.
Yes.
But there is also a material reckoning which is written down in the holy books, and at that time, at that level, they are
yes,
not
sure
religious texts, but they are social or political texts.
Not totally. If you look at Moses 3, third book of Moses, chapter 25, you see something like, I would call it ecological breaks on human activity. So even in that times, it was very clear, if you follow this or follow that, you follow the moon, that you will not be so fast as if you follow the sun. So you mm-hmm have clear cut criteria for against, I would call it, over-exploitation, against over-competition. So if you understand religion as a first attempt to understand reality, and mm-hmm afterwards you have philosophy, you have science, today we have technology, so in these times we are moving from more from science to technology, so we have something like a new strata of this thinking, so we come from religion, then we moved into philosophy, we went into science, now we're moving into technology. And but even in such ancient texts like Moses 3, you can and of course this is also mixed with Hammurabi and Ur-Nammu and all these things, no doubt about that.
Yeah, but, yeah, because all of these biblical texts, they are
yes,
taken from
the
much earlier
region
texts.
From the same region. You have Sumeria, Mesopotamia, this thing you have yeah inside that, you know. You're, everybody who says something else is a liar. That's for sure.
So that's this discrimination between the us versus them.
If somebody says that God dictated this, then he is not telling the truth. Science is about truth. It's not about political measures or guiding somebody here or there. So it can be clearly found out that when texts were written, when they were edited, and if somebody says all the thing is from one source, then it's not true. That's important. And we cannot just teach things that are not true. That's is not a good attitude. And
yeah,
the other is insiders, outsiders, of course, is difficult because many people are taught the Bible and it's a holy book and now shut up. You know, it's something like now you can't, and if you know us, what is the Bible, that cannot distinguish between the many fragments that have been collected. There are many fragments, much of these fragments contain wisdom. Yeah, much of these things contain truths, but you cannot say, okay, it's all this is if you look into the cave of Dina, you have not so nice things. Then you have okay, maybe it talks about human cruelty too. You know, so it's something like a manual. You can learn things and. That's it. And of course, you have these or them. I don't know when it would was anyway accepted. Henry George, I think, was the first to outnumber the selling of the Bible. So Henry George's book was sold more than the Bible.
Yeah. Of course, there is a difference between who's telling people to buy the book. and when do people choose for themselves? And I think that that's one of the crucial issues which we have to deal with the enigma of banking.
Yeah.
And one of the by what you just said, it's a very nice point for me to bring up some of the fundamentals that I'm always working with. When you say that there is a difference in the knowledge of, say, a religion or science, then in the body we can see that there are actually four brain centers. So there's a place where we can think about things, the place where we can feel about things, the place where we can want or do things, and the place where we are things. And they're called, respectively, the head, the heart, the hara, and the holy bone. And so in the head, we basically have a perspective of reality separate from reality. So, as you could say, the head is separated from the body in that sense, and actually the nerves cross over between the head and the body.
That's right. All experiments show that.
Yeah. And so when you look at the head, we can basically have our individualistic, selfish picture of the world there.
Yes.
In the heart, we are operating at the level of the lungs, doing the in and out movement, and the heart doing the in and out movement at the organ level. So basically that is where we are part of the tides of the universe. And basically that's also the organic system or the animal
like
system.
Di corpo, Lisa Di Corpo there, and Vanini, they are doing this research. It's very good, yes? They actually go into that, yes, about the heart. Very good research.
So when you look at the difference between the head and the heart, in the head there is separateness. Basically that's the perspective of classical science, the outsider observer. But in the heart or in the chest area, at the animal level or organ level, we are actually part of it and we are responding to it. We're participating in it. Then at the deeper level of the hara or the gut, of course, that is where the vegetative level works. In that sense, the gut is the roots of the tree of life in our body. And then you can see that the relationship of involvement is very different yet again, because in a way we are right in the middle of it. And we cannot really get out of it. So in the head we are outside of it.
Yes.
In the heart we are in the tidal zone between them. And in the gut we are sort of involved in it. And the deepest level of the holy bone is where we are actually totally embedded within it. So the holy bone is where you see the body cell that has created the bone and resides within its own ivory tower temple.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the thing I want to bring up, connecting to what you said, that there are these different levels of understanding, and religion has a different perspective of it than science. So science is basically what happens in the head, and religion is more what happens in the heart.
It depends.
I needed to make that distinction to get more clarity in those relationships of the involvement that we have. But then, of course, once you see that knowledge has a perspective which is based on our involvement in it, then you can also see that the different cultural codes of the so-called holy book of the different tribes, they also reflect a different kind of involvement. But what seems to be lacking all the time is the connection between all four elements. And what therefore is also lacking is the relationship between the individual and humanity and the collective. So capitalism sort of capitalizes on the individual, as we discussed in the geonomics conversations. And communism focuses on the collectivism, but both of them are value. And most important, we need to relate the one and the other in everything that we do. And that seems to be lost at the moment that people give a fixed code of behavior, like in the holy books, and also take that over in books of law or books of finance. And that is also the difference between, say, the physical properties or the spiritual properties. If you're in the head, you're dealing with pure ideas, so that's the only thing that you have. If you're in the body, you deal with the physical, and that's what is real at that level. But there, too, we need to mediate between both of them. And the physical body sort of stays behind when we die, and the information that we have collected within us, that seems to travel along as we go out. As an embryologist said, don't be surprised that when we are born, basically we go out of the womb into another reality, and in the reality of the womb before, we thought that that's the only way that things can be. And so when we die, why is it not that our body is like the uterus, or and the earth is our placenta, and that what has developed in us as an electromagnetic information field, which is incoherent, coherence cannot travel on. But evidently, you don't need pockets for that in your dead shirt.
You know, it's difficult now to bring these things together. You know, we see burial laws and what how should be a person buried and the.
Basically, let me put it in this perspective, because we are talking about the holy books and the codes
soul,
of conduct
the
for
soul.
Different cultures.
The but soul what is we, important.
Yeah, yeah. What we seek to resolve is to go beyond these books.
We have to go beyond the book. Because the books are fragments, fragments.
Yeah.
So, and if we remain with fragments, then we remain with the tribal aspect. So that's for sure. So if we remain only with fragments, then we remain in this tribal tribal state. Despite all technological or technical progress, we remain in a tribal state. We have we have fragments. Some fragments are precise. Some are not. If you look at proverbs. Proverbs in the Bible are different from Ecclesiastes and all these things. You know, it's only just to mention some books. Or you have Ezekiel, and so you need a lot and written seen from this from today. It's different. You see the prophets in other function, and it can be of great inspiration if your aim is universal human emancipation. If your aim is universal human emancipation. And this is why many people got into more into the secular arena. Today I was thinking about Bela Gutmann, who was a soccer player and went over the whole world. And he made also this Gutmann curse. He cursed Benfica Lisbon when they didn't give him a pay rise. And afterwards, in fact, were no more winning. And Eusebio went to his grave in Vienna and asked him before the final in the Champions League to revoke the curse, the Gutmann curse in soccer. And so there are many, many phenomena that are very funny, very funny things. But, you know, a soccer player, 1990, went in Vienna Central Friedhof. He went there to the Jewish section and Man Bela, please revoke the curse of Gutmann. And Bela Gutmann is also in this Hall of Fame in American soccer. So there are many, many phenomena, and these people went into the secular field because they were fed up with these religious things. They're totally fed up, totally fed up. That somebody says, okay, you know, it's, I saw this discussion now, but it's very far now from banking. Which type of marriage and is homosexual allowed? Homosexuality allowed via the Bible, not allowed. Sometimes somebody thinks, what is happening? What do they want to find out? It's almost impossible to find out. But if you find it out, then you cannot find a law that totally forbids, for example, a homosexual relationship. You cannot. You have a preference for procreation. That's for sure. No, but and you go ahead. Monogamy versus polygamy. You know, polygamy is allowed, but it's not. Again, you have a preference for monogamy because it's economically easier. So again, it reduces to economic relationships, and this is why.
I'd like to connect up to that, because what you're bringing up now is something which I have looked at in detail, because I realize that there are levels of development within us, and what you're now talking about is the level of sexual maturity. But that parallels the growing up from baby to child to adolescent to adult. And in a way, you can also say that the baby level is, say, the sexless phase, that sexuality is not relevant for that specific being. And at the child level, there will be at some point a discovery that the hands hang down to the level of the genitalia. So a mutual contact is logical.
That's for
and,
sure.
I tend to call that the level of masturbation.
Yes,
that
of
people
course.
Can discover their own body rhythm and their
yes,
own
yes,
body
yes,
response.
Yes, of course, yes, of course.
And at the next level, and that's then in puberty, you realize that there is a difference between the electrification of the male and the female. The female basically is hormonal based and the male is predominantly neuronal based, but the complementarity of the two electromagnetic fields creates that a kind of stereo phenomenon can be activated, which by the way has been well described by Wilhelm Reich.
Wilhelm Reich, very good.
And then as a result you can get to the fourth level of sexual maturity or sexual experience, which is essentially described by the Taoist or in the Tantra Yoga, where you discover that these electromagnetic fields are related and to the body and found in the body, but they actually also exist in themselves by themselves. So once you have found them, you can actually operate with them and by them. And so then these levels of sexual involvement, as you said, from the asexual to, let's call it masturbational level, and I would consider the the lesbian and the homosexual versions part of that, because it does not go to the third level of activating that differential between the male and the female electromagnetic field and their complementarity.
Yes. It's very
and as a result, that let's call it the turning inside out or the higher awareness, which Wilhelm Reich described, cannot be used as the Taoist and the Tantra Yoga addresses.
Uh-huh.
But in that same way, I see that there is this need of this growing up in society. We know that the baby is sort of dependent on everything, but I see that a lot of people in banking system are kept in this baby dependence.
Yes,
and that, at that level, the
comparison is good because now we have reached an important point. Christine von Braun has written a lot about sexuality and money. She is something I don't know from Werner von Braun, a relative, but I don't know in which line. So I had many communications with her on via email. She's a very learned woman. And she also makes this comparison between sexuality and money and banking. So, and of course, today banking money has reached the Viagra stage.
Nice way of putting it. Yeah.
So we are. It's has more to do with infertility, impotency. And absolute with artificial things, so it has nothing,
and if you,
no more to do with real relationships between people.
Yeah, and if you look at it from the political perspective, the banking system which exists now is at the level of a dictatorship. And when you talk about the geonomics, yeah, I like that. And when you look at the level of what you described in geonomics. Then you can get the local communities can also get their local currency to work, and Stroud and other cities have been using that for a long time already.
It's real spam.
So that's where you would then go into, say, a democratic, an oligarchic form of banking. But when these different tribes or cities can connect up and have a shared financial system between them, and the Wir in Switzerland is one example of that. Then you go to, let's call it, the democratic kind of banking system. But what is needed is that everybody knows that they are the individual bearers of all values in whatever financial system that they use. And at that level, you can grow up into the autarkic or the sovereign financial system. And it is in a way as if in the banking system, humanity that makes use of that banking system has been kept back in the past of, say, 6,000, 8,000 years ago. And the development is stagnated because people are making abusive use of the dependency of others, because they cannot determine their own money, they cannot determine their own economic laws, they cannot determine their own legal laws, and thus they basically live as slaves. And that is essentially for me the where I would like to provide a solution. so that people can realize that what the bankers do, they can do individually as well. In the way that the bankers create money, they can do it themselves as well.
That's absolutely sure.
And then we can grow up from this individualistic level to the awareness at the level of humanity. For me, that's a growing up, and I needed a bit of time to put that all in perspective.
It's good, but genomics is, if you want, organic sex. And the banking system today is Viagra sex. So it's really the opposite. It's something. It's technical fertilization. No, it's all this use of Deus ex machina. No, it's Deus ex machina, and it does not allow the creature. And now we don't have. Okay, in my worldview, the creature that has been endowed by certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, happiness, and so on, you know it. Mm-hmm. And this type of system alienates us from unalienable rights. So we have inalienable rights, and this type of living alienates us from our rights to live. This is why I, and of course, my ethical agenda is based. I would call it on biblical criteria, but it is from a Unitarian point of view, or if you like, a Junitarian point of view. It is a humanistic orientation. So everybody has to choose for his own. I cannot tell my son or my daughter or any other, even not my wife, what she should do, or my father, how he should be buried, and so on. Everybody has to decide on his own. Not will be left on his own, but decides on his own. Huh? Like it's what in Yiddish is called "Wekin Leben Oistrete Musika Jeder Allein." So everybody has to do his own pathway. And the tendency that we have that it that inalienable rights, and this is also about this Ellerman article, is only is from the legal point is a good argumentation about the contract laws, and this is not humanistic. It is against human nature, and is in my opinion against creation. So against creation, as I can read it out from I would say the Torah and related literature. Even
That's why I started to look at the solution, not at the cosmic level, or not at the religious level, or not at the political level, but in what happens in the biology of our body. Because we all have a body, and evidently what happens within us is what we can express outside of us. Unalienable rights, which you called, which you referred to, are essentially the properties that we find in our body. We do have freedom of choice, we do have free will, we do have free expression, we do have free association and dissociation.
Indeed.
But there is something that needs to be connected to relate the individual to the collective.
Yes.
And for what I see, that requires a growing up from the human to realize that, yes, we are individual, but at the same time, we create an added value in the relationship that we have. We can then maintain or entertain these values in groups, as a result of which they are not an up and down or to and fro balance, but they actually can circle around, they can cycle around and form the basis of the group dynamic.
Yes.
And at a larger level, that is actually what then dissipates out into humanity. But one of the things that plays a role at that level is that when you look at the individual, the relationship, the groups and humanity, there are different levels of consciousness involved. So at the individual level, we are conscious. In the relationship, we are subconscious. In the groups, we are unconscious. And for humanity, or the world around us, we are unconscious in a way. For the cells, it's the other way around. Cells are always conscious.
Yes,
in organs, they are subconscious. In the body, they are unconscious. And for the cells, the outside world is out of consciousness.
Yes, it's an evolutionary process.
But also a logic. So there's more to it than just that. It is something that we could look into. I have a question which is very pragmatic, however, at this point. We are getting close to the 1 hour of the recording, and our experience is that a bit later the sound quality completely deteriorates. So I'd like to suggest that we round off this part of the recording.
Yeah.
And then I don't know how much time you have to go on after that.
We can talk we continue a bit next afterwards. I'm not in a rush.
Okay. Okay, then I'll just do a bit of a summary of where we stand for now. We started to look at the enigma of banking.
Yes.
That's the theme that we are exploring now. And you've already brought up the notion that it is about the people sharing what they find on Earth. And that there is a transition from people sharing to people bartering and trading. And that as a result, something came into the picture, which is that the tribes within them, they can always share, but between tribes or between cultures, they will barter. But at the moment that they're bartering with each other, they are also having to reconcile the cultural differences between them. And as a result, we can see that in many cases that has not been resolved. And due to that, we then came to a series of explorations where I, from my perspective, added the idea that I seek to solve that dilemma between the outsider perspective and the insider perspective by showing how that works in the body, and I refer to the difference between the head, the heart, the hara, and the holy bone. And there is a lot that we can then build up on in this already. We've already come to see that the texts which people use to describe this tribal behavior evidently cannot be applicable to the other tribes. So that means that the holy books do not function as books of law for others, and they cannot function as a book of banking for others. Evidently, in the banking business or the banking industry, that has been denied or ignored. And the banking system has been created as if it applies to all people regardless of their cultural differences by referring to material values or material amounts instead of individual values, which would be individual qualities. Would you be willing to round off from your perspective in a minute or less, that we can still have a quality of the recording?
About a minute. Yes, the analogy is very good between the economy and the human body. So we have cellular level molecules, and these stages interact is a very good analogy. Following from this is that banking went into it lost embodied cognition, so there's no more embodied cognition in banking. It's totally cut off from the organic thinking, from the organic world. It's only the head, only brains working, and some abstractions done, and some numbers counting. So it's totally lost its equivalence in nature. And therefore, it has to be put back into this monetary and banking things have to be put into some natural ratio. Some natural ratio has to be reintroduced. This is the first remedy. And this can be done by geonomic thinking. That's, I think, something like a little summary. And now, at this level, it functions really as Viagra. It's nothing more. It's too much Viagra,
which is basically a kind of self-rape drug, to put it that way. It does not respect the natural thing, but imposes something else of the expectations of others.
To the normal process, a normal sexual progress that you see a woman and maybe or is I was talking not about me. I'm heterosexual, and you see a woman, you maybe get an extraction and all these things. You know what is in a normal human body functioning, and it's cut off. You got you get your chemicals, and then you got your you know. That's not the way how it should function, and it's been cut off. It's no more embodied cognition. It's only
okay, and that is precisely what we are trying to resolve. But that's also where I will now disconnect the recording for the simple reason that the sound otherwise will collapse, and I'll come back to you.
Okay.
One moment, please.
All the best.